Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
It's spinning! It's spinning! Jonathan Sexton has made it!
Do you feel moderately happy?
No, I feel like I've been kissing my sister, I suppose.
In the pocket for his drop goal attempt. Here he goes, O'Gara. He's done it! That surely is the grand slam.
We target players all the time. That's part of rugby, isn't it? Let me know.
Sexton, wonderful pass and Stockdale finishes.
There'll be more than grenades. There'll be full tanks and full shells landing on the Aviva.
Grand Slam winners on St. Patrick's Day at Twickenham.
Now then, you're very welcome along. So it's Wednesday Night Rugby. We are streaming live on Facebook and all our social channels. We are coming to you on the radio as well. Round three of the Six Nations nearly upon us. France against Wales kicks things off, or France against Scotland rather kicks things off at the Stade de France at 2:15. Wales-England is the big one. That's in Cardiff on Saturday at 4:45, and then at 3 p.m. Irish time, it is Italy against Rome on the Sunday. We have Keith Wood standing by. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
A rare treat to have you on Wednesday Night Rugby these days.
No, it's not. I was around last week. I was superfluous to requirements. So such is life every now and then, you know what I mean? Bigger guys were on. It was great. Much better off, actually, having Gary Ringrose on, I have to say. We can hear from a present player is never any harm. So
you are never superfluous, okay? I want you to know that.
I had great difficulty saying that, actually. It was kind of interesting that my lisp was coming back to haunt me. It's good. Bloody really exciting rugby at the present moment in time. I think we all needed a little break at the weekend. It didn't do us any harm.
No. So Andy Dunn is here as well. Hello.
Hey, Joe.
Also never superfluous. It is hard to say.
Very nice of you to say.
So, as things stand, England 10 points, Wales 8 points, Scotland 5 points and Ireland 4 points. I think realistically, Ireland's say in winning this Six Nations Championship is pretty much a whisper. And that will be all but confirmed if England beat Wales. But there is a glimmer of hope if it goes the other way. Let's start with Rome and work our way backwards. Generally, Keith, I mean, OK, there are exceptions. There's the Raj drop goal in 2011. Joe Schmidt often references Declan Kidney's last game, the 22-15 defeat, where everything that could go wrong did go wrong, including Peter O'Mahony on the wing at one stage. But for all intents and purposes, the Italians on a given day seem to be as far away from beating Six Nations opposition as ever.
Yeah, I think so. And I know we've discussed this in the past. I often felt that the Italy that got into the Six Nations, which disturbingly is 19 years ago now, were almost too late. They should have been in about 5 years beforehand. And they've been, you know, playing catch up ever since. And every now and then they seem to kind of get a bit of rugby together. I think the referees play them off the park. I think they don't really have the full level of discipline that's required under pressure, and consistently don't, and have suffered for that for a period of time. They also have utter huge reliance on Sergio Parisse for nearly that whole period of time. He's out at the weekend. It'll be interesting to see whether other people step up, and because he does everything. And I would say at this stage of his career, he does everything when he shouldn't be. He should be doing his own job and doing one job, and other guys should be doing it. I remember when Conor O'Shea took over, he'd looked at the way the under-20s had gone in the previous two or three seasons. He's a smart cookie. You can almost see the frustration visible on his face all the time. He's tried to make an awful lot of things change, not just in the national team, but through the game in Italy. They have started to make moves in the Pro 14 for the first time this year. So suddenly things are popping up a little bit, but everybody else is accelerating away from them. It's maybe it's just professionalism, but the game has not really taken a stop at any stage. Yeah. When you look at how England have jumped on, how Ireland have in the last couple of years, how Scotland have, and even when things don't go well for them, they're still playing some pretty decent rugby. Mm. Wales haven't lost a game for a while. So, I mean, their only thing that offers any scant hope for them is France. And like, there's no way that would ever have been part of a conversation even 4 or 5 years ago. Mm. So I think it's very tough for them. I fully expect Ireland to go down and win well. But Ireland, that's Ireland that goes and performs. And we have been off the mark so far in this championship.
Sure. On one of Keith's latter points there, Andy, ties in, it echoes what Conor O'Shea said at the outset of this tournament, which is that I assure you we are improving. Mm. The problem is every other side, maybe bar France, I suppose, but the problem is basically every other side is improving too. So that gap ain't closing.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things I like that they've done. From a structural point of view of their whole rugby system, they've actually kind of copied the Irish system, and a lot of their better players are not playing in Italy, but if they stick with it, they'll probably attract guys back in time. Steve Abboud went over, it wasn't really well documented. He's a guy who helped at underage level kind of set up academies in Ireland, and he's working on that in the background. And Woody mentioned the under 20 setup, and they've had a few wins at that level. And they've also involved Wayne Smith, which is always a good idea because he's one of the kind of great coaches in the history of the game. And I think much like the Argies involved Graham Henry prior to the 2015 World Cup, even for a year or two, and obviously they're at a slightly higher playing field, that kind of consultant level input is going to have a more immediate effect rather than the long-term development stuff that they're doing through academies and Steve Abboud. So they're all things that I think we ought to admire. When Woody was playing Five Nations games and then Six Nations games, Italy had, they had a fulcrum around Troncon at nine and Dominguez, and they were world-class. Mm-hmm. And their only world-class operator for the last five, maybe seven, 8 years is Parise. And it's much more difficult to have an impact on a game as an eight to affect things to a greater extent. They need a couple of world-class guys in point-scoring positions or in positions where they can influence the game to a greater degree. I mean, Parise is one of the, it'll go down as one of the greatest kind of heroic triers in the history of international rugby.
So over 100 test defeats, which is one of the most records.
It's just so unfair on the guy. But yeah. I mean, Parise, Troncon, Dominguez axis would have been a scary prospect for most international sides. But they just, as long as teams currently are improving and accelerating, their rate of improvement is slower. I still think they're worth their place in the Six Nations. They will improve. And I think, unfortunately, it could be a case where Conor O'Shea is sitting at home on an armchair watching what he built come to its fruition in 5 to 10 years, you know, because obviously results matter too. But I'd love to see him given an opportunity because he's doing it the right way.
Well, he was on the show last night and he's not thinking too far beyond the World Cup and the next Six Nations, and then he's going to decide, and there's family issues and various other things for him to consider. So we'll see. Maybe he'll stay longer and see the plans come to fruition.
Yes.
From the Irish point of view for this game, it's very early in the week, given it's a Sunday kickoff, to have team news, so we don't really have too much, not as much as we might usually have on a Wednesday. But the early word seems to be it's going to be a strong Irish side. We're not going to have a raft of changes in the way Wales did. Sexton should start. Again, that comes with a massive health warning. We don't know. Injuries, Toner obviously out for the tournament. Ringrose is out. Stander is still out. Henderson and Tyburn are back. Will Addison has been ruled out, and Andrew Conway is back in. So that's in
is Will Addison
terms,
injured?
He's back trouble.
Okay.
So he's it's been a bit, ruled it's out.
It's a little bit disturbing. When we looked at the very start of this Six Nations, we would have said, God, we're in hale and hearty form. Mm-hmm. We have depth charts to dream about, really. And we've had a fairly attritional 2 or 3 weeks.
We have. Joe Schmidt has made the point he hopes that this Six Nations acts as a kind of vaccination, was his word, against what happened in 2015 happening again. But if anything, it just proves that as much as we talk about depth charts, that really, you know, you can't really vaccinate against injuries. None of us could have foreseen that Quinn Roo would be playing against Scotland. For all the planning, for all the infrastructure, you can just be horribly unlucky. There is nothing to say Sexton and Carberry won't both be injured in a bad couple of weeks in Japan. I mean, maybe 2015 really is about 90% just rotten bad luck and 10% iffy planning. I suppose Madigan could have had more games. But, you know, really, you need a massive dollop of luck, Keith, for this whole thing to work out, as much as we try and talk about bloodying lots of players.
I do, actually. Very few sports people ever want to discuss luck because they're not in control of it. Mm. And you want to be in control of every single facet of the game that you possibly can, of your training, your preparation, your coaching, your analysis, everything. And that doesn't really work when you bring luck into it. But a guy rolls an ankle for no reason other than he slipped on the ground. That's an injury. Could be out for 6 weeks. You know, heavy collisions happen all the time. And we are still not the biggest team in the world, you know. And we play a style that is quite hard on us. Mm. And if we play against big, hard, heavy teams, you know, no, we don't always come off second best, but we often do. So, you know, there's luck and there's also ways of playing differently. I mean, if we take one example, being Johnny Sexton, and a lot of people talked about his bravery, taking the ball to the line and complained about the late tackles. They're not late tackles. They're tackles that have to be made mm-hmm. as a guy is leaving go of the ball. If he doesn't leave go of it and you decide, well, I can't really hit him because there's a chance he might leave go of the ball, that's why there's a bit of a window that you can tackle. They're not outside the window. I would say that if he goes and does that all the time and goes off injured all the time, he has to change. I don't want my 10 to be sitting inside on the physio bench. And you can say, well, if he changes, then he's not the same player. Well, there's a risk item with that. So, and I don't know that he fully needs to be as exposed as that. I thought it was fine, great, lovely, but I wanted him to get up off the ground after it, and he went off. So I don't want that. Mm.
Richie Murphy was talking about that today at Carton House, and he echoed that line, Andy, which is, you know, well, he's not going to be the same player. You know, this is just too integral to how he plays the game.
If he was a bit more like Richie, he wouldn't be getting injured. Richie was not a physical player. Richie was an incredible kicker out of hand, but he played so deep in the pocket that no one could get. There was no question of physical contact.
And how flat to the line was a young Andy Dunn?
I was very flat to the line, and I got a lot of injuries, I was going to say.
A shit ton of injuries,
yeah. I was going to say. And I think there's absolute merit in what Woody's talking about. And now it's tricky because you talk about great strikers, or you talk about Luis Suarez, you know, if he doesn't bite a guy's arm, is he still the same striker? Like, there's been a lot of comparisons from Lancaster, from Johnny himself, around Tom Brady and his influence and his longevity. And Tom Brady goes nowhere near contact either. And he still manages to run a game.
Sorry to interrupt, because you can tease out this point as well. Yeah. Brian O'Driscoll was in the Monday after the game.
Yeah.
And he said that in that instance, say, let's take the Murrayfield example as the one to work with, that Sexton made absolutely sure he was putting Stockdale through by taking it to the last millisecond.
Yes.
And O'Driscoll's argument was, well, you know, he can let that ball go a fraction of a second or two earlier.
Yeah.
He will still give Stockdale a great chance of getting through.
Yeah.
But equally, the window Keith talks about that the opposition player has to smash the number 10, it just makes that a slightly bigger window, and maybe Sexton doesn't get hit with the full force that he's getting hit with currently. So is that an option to him? And he gives Stockdale a little bit more work to do.
Well, I think it's fully an option. I think while you don't want to take the aggression out of Johnny's game, how combative he is, and he asks a lot of questions by playing flat, but you can ask a lot of questions by introducing variation into the game, and sometimes playing flat and sometimes playing deep, and that would bring variation into our game on the whole, because at the moment we don't have a lot. If he was to drop back, you know, Joey Carberry plays deeper. He's still a threat when he needs to be, but he freed up space for Kearney on two or three occasions in the second half, and we're not getting access to that at the moment when Johnny's there, because we're so flat to the line. We're asking questions closer, and Johnny's in the firing line physically for that. He's brave to a fault. I think for the sake of variation in our attack and for the sake of self-preservation for him, he needs to drop back a bit. And I don't think that's a defeat or a change of character or personality or anything like that. And I know, as a young guy playing who played flat, and any other young guys who played flat, you're always in the... there's a query on your health around playing 10, that flat to the line. And when you keep damaging yourself and you stand up, a guy like Woody, who's in front of you,
yeah.
or any other guy saying, actually, we don't want you off the field. We'd much rather you preserve yourself a bit longer and run our team for 80 minutes.
No, it's a fair point. And in so much as you can, explain to me why a slightly deeper number 10 will bring a Rob Kearney into the game more.
Well, if I suppose when you play extremely flat to the line, to add width to passes, you're at far too much risk of a man and ball tackle. So the ball arrives, the defence is still pushing up, and a guy gets hit at the same time, or you're way more susceptible to interceptions. But if you were to stand, for example, to counter, if you're to play deep, the way we play now, it wouldn't work either. You can't stand deep and bring forwards into the game standing deep, because they're going to get smashed behind the gain line. So for our game to be productive as it is, we need Johnny to be flat and bring forwards in close to the ruck. That works brilliantly. I'm just saying, drop back a bit for the wider game. At the moment, we're not quite doing that. Not as much as I'd like.
No, it's a fair point, and there's more variation. I'll bring you in a second, Keith, but we'll give our resident number 10 first dibs at it. You know, you're starting to see pieces in the paper now about Carberry versus Sexton. Mm. How live a debate is that, really?
I think it's not that live a debate in a World Cup season. I think next December it's going to be a much more live debate. Yeah. I just think a fit, healthy Johnny is still completely central to how the team operates, to how Joe wants us to operate. And I think Joey has massively improved and the exposure to regular game time, the exposure to, say, a disappointing game in Castraway and a response of, I think, 22 straight place kicks, for example. I don't think he's missed one in his last 22.
No.
That's incredibly good for his confidence, for the Irish team, for Munster rugby. And then the couple of mistakes, the early intercept in Scotland and the exposure to that and his response. So he's shown he's very, very resilient and capable of being a top-level international 10. It's not that live a debate for me, because there's an apex of control in the Irish team. It's Joe Schmidt who controls everything, and then there's Johnny, who's his kind of his general on the field, who still controls everything. I actually don't think that's a healthy structure, but it's the one that's worked best for us. I just think it exposes us to too much risk when a guy gets injured. But with that in mind, I don't think there's any question Johnny's going to start the key games and the key games in the World Cup.
Yeah, I would have thought so. Keith, Carberry an improving backup, but still very much the backup.
I do, but I think he's exciting backup and a very different 10. And I like the difference in the 10 from it, much and all as I like Johnny's. And it's funny when we have these conversations, you know it, because we get people saying, and God, they're writing them off already. And he was player of the year, you know, world player of the year last year and all that. Of course we're not. But what we're trying to do is have a discussion over what puts us in the best position possible come World Cup time, which we know is the exact same thought process that Joe Schmidt's having, with more information than we're having, right? So, and he has set out his stall of what he likes and who he likes and how they like to play. I think ultimately he'd like Joey Carberry to have a little bit more of the control that Johnny has, but still keep that bit of a spark or the ability to accelerate onto a ball, and which we don't see as much of from Johnny anymore. And that's fine and right, by the way. And when we're talking about changing to not give that pass, I want him to give that pass and get creamed at it. And we win a World Cup on the back of it. We score in the last couple of minutes and he goes off. Then I think that's an acceptable time to get hurt and go off. But I can tell you every player that goes past 30, and I played for 2 years past 30. I retired, you know, just shy of my 32nd birthday. You change your game because you change so that you can be more effective. Mm. And it's funny how people would say it's self-preservation and all that. It's not. It's about effectiveness on the field. If you're a better team with you on the field, you want to stay on the field. You want to do more. You want to do different types of things. You want to bide your time when you need to. You want your game moments to be magic, to lead to scores, to lead to huge changes in a game. Johnny Sexton does that all the time. There's no criticism of that fact because he just does it all the time. Mm. The problem is when he does it, he often gets battered and goes off the field. I still want him on the field. So whatever it's not even a mindset change, whatever the structural change for how he goes about the game to keep him on the field for 75 minutes, I'd rather that than 25. That's all I'm saying.
It's not a complex fix either. I think it's just a matter of adding in the variation. He's perfectly capable. When Johnny first came on the scene, one of his first ever starts for Leinster was in, it was either Thomond or Musgrave, and it was 06. And he wasn't the type of player he is now. I'm probably young and more callow, and he wasn't as bulked up. But he was an incredibly good wide game passer. Like, he could throw a bullet off both hands. And I remember the last game ever in the old Lansdowne Road was New Year's Eve 2006. Mm. He started that game. And if you go watch a rerun of that, his passing game is exceptional in terms of width and delivery away. So it's not like he can't do it. He could just, I think it's an easy fix. It's just dropping back into the pocket a bit more often than he has done in recent times.
Yeah, okay. We are streaming, as I mentioned, on Facebook. Get your comments in. You can win the Heineken Star Comment of the Week. There's some very nice prizes, match day tickets, off the ball, branded goodies. Let's just race through some quick points here because I do want to touch on the other two games. They are very interesting this week. Quickly then, Conor Murray is a slight cause for concern. I don't know if we can quite put his form down to rust, Andy. He's had enough minutes now to find his way back. I'm conscious that a number 9 and probably a number 10 can be the first victims when a team is going backwards and is lacking momentum. What are you seeing with Murray? Can the team do anything to help him get out of a bit of a rut?
Yeah, I think I would call it a rut. I think that I think teams are very aware of her box kick, and I was at a Heineken or whatever it's called, the Champions Cup game 2 years ago.
That says everything.
Exactly. It was Glasgow away, and it was huge furore afterwards because
they went after his standing leg.
Now, while teams are thankfully not all as cynical as that Glasgow side were, teams are going after disrupting the source of ball for Conor, the speed at which it comes back. They'll all try and get in a really challenge, like a diving challenge towards his feet as he kicks, and like England put Vunipola in the backfield. There's going to be multiple ways to counter it.
Yeah.
Now, there are also multiple ways to clear your lines, and as long as Conor has been asked to do that, take the burden of responsibility of that, he can't just keep pinging these magical kicks up in the air with all those variables against him. I think he just needs to be absolved of that responsibility, give it to Johnny. Like, what's to say Johnny can't kick it 60 metres down the field and we trust our defensive line, or a miss pass to Kearney and use his left foot? With two passes, you bring up their back three and it makes space in the backfield. Again, they're very easy fixes for, like, tacticians like Schmidt and Sexton and Murray. Mm. I can't quite fathom why they haven't done it yet, but I actually think it's got to a point where it's affecting Connor's like speed of delivery at the ruck, and he just needs to go back to basics, be allowed pass quickly, clear the ball away, get some momentum in his game, take a bit of responsibility out of it, and it won't be an issue.
Am I getting too Machiavellian to think that there is a broad Joe Schmidt plan where he's lulling everybody in, and you know the opposition will only see the tapes of Murray box kicking, and then come World Cup time we'll see a lot more variety?
I don't think so. I think Joe is, it's been a great strength of his in terms of our successes, that the level of control he exerts on how the team plays. And to introduce a sudden change and a lot of variety into a game at World Cup in order to subterfuge, I don't think he's going to relinquish that control.
It would go against history, I appreciate, if he started doing that. Yeah.
It would be a genius move, mind you, but I don't.
Yeah. No, it would. Murray, Keith?
Yeah, I think he is a little bit rusty. And I also think that we haven't been winning the ball on the front foot for quite a while. So he came back into the Munster team that was having to fight for every single piece of it. And he wasn't getting it quite as well as he was. And he was a long time out as well. And neck injuries are very, very tricky. I do think we are a little bit over-reliant on the box kick, but we... And one of the reasons why it isn't a 60-metre kick from Johnny Sexton is that an awful lot of the box kicks were done so that Ireland would win back maybe 50 or 60% of them. They expected it as a way of getting further up the field. I would have said an awful lot of the reason why the box kicking was so much was Ireland seemed to be playing in the wrong third of the field for an awful lot of the last two games.
Yeah.
We were pressurised back into it. And I'd also say that very starkly in this Six Nations, the amount of interference lines of players running across to protect their catcher of the ball has made it a far harder, just a simple kick and run down a straight line. And you've one player jumping v one player. I mean, it's dodging your way through everything.
Sorry to interrupt. That's all perfectly legal, is it? Because Schmidt was complaining about that.
No, it's not. It's not all perfectly legal. Some of it is. But the manner in which they're doing it is... So the way England did it was they actually flooded players into that area.
Yeah, there was like a wall of them at one stage.
Provided you don't run across the line looking deliberately, that is absolutely illegal.
Okay.
But you don't have to get out of the way for anybody.
Yeah.
Well, look, there's Stockdale running up. I better get out of the way or I might be penalised. No, you don't. You just can't step into the line.
Yeah.
But actually, if you're five or six guys there, you're going to block everything. So you could see it in some of our chases. I think some of the kicks were a little bit too long, but some of our chases weren't at 100% either for the very simple reason they couldn't plot a course to get there.
Yeah.
And they're not going to sprint up and be sidestepped out of it because they can't get there in time. So
I think
a lot of that is good play.
Yeah.
I have to say, I went to the England game, and it's interesting watching, not on telly, and seeing Vunipola, and I think they were protecting him a little, and I don't think it was all just about great play, but actually he caused havoc. Even if when he got the ball, whether he caught it or was past it, he's just so hard to tackle. It takes an awful lot out of different guys, and it changed the impetus over to England and took it away from Ireland, whereas those box kicks had always been kind of pushing Ireland forward.
Just a last point I wanted to get both your thoughts on, again, briefly, if we can here. So Rob Kearney, in what was a brilliant show of honesty during the week, he was interviewed, and frankly, he said, yeah, look, I mean, I sat down with Robbie Henshaw and I did go through some video stuff with him, but I mean, I'd be lying if I said I wanted him to shoot the lights out. I was sat at home and I didn't want him to do that, which is good. So he's going off the PR line, which is I just wanted the team to win. If we're still saying that there is an issue with who steps in if Rob Kearney is to get injured in Japan, then are we expecting Henshaw to get a run at 15 on Sunday? I presume Bundiaki and Chris Farrell could do a job at centre. Like, if Schmidt is very serious about getting Henshaw up to speed, he doesn't have many competitive Ireland games to do so, Andy.
No, he doesn't.
Now, Rob Kearney is probably, you know, if he is listening, going, what the hell do I have to do? We're talking about the backup.
I get it. No, and firstly, I think, I would also commend Rob for his honesty. I love it because... How many homogenised interviews have you done with sportsmen in the last 3 years, Joe? I'm sure far too many.
Several with Rob Kearney back in the day. Yeah, but when you're that bit older, you can be honest.
Yeah, and he's afforded himself that. It's nice to hear it. It's refreshing. And thankfully, it's not being thrown back in his face or misquoted or anything that. So he's just been frank. And in terms of Henshaw... He's to me a very viable option at fullback immediately, regardless of a bad game against England, because he cut his teeth at fullback in weaker Connacht sides where his positioning and his anticipation had to be excellent. He wasn't helped in a very, an Irish side that was deconstructed against England. Keith Earls was carrying a knock as well, so he wasn't defending as part of a back three. He was part of a back two and a half, and he was covering additional ground. He was also very rusty in full-back play. But he's an intelligent guy with huge ability. And
the rusty in back play, the rustiness in full-back play is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but I think that would be almost gone after the England game. And I would agree with you, effectively, and I'd say I would give him another start in an international. I think Italy would be an ideal place to do it. Do I think Josh Pitt's going to do it? Probably not.
No.
But that's what I would do.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
What do you think, Keith?
Yeah, I thought it was a very interesting call. I believe in Robbie Henshaw. I just think he has the skills. I said it beforehand. I love the fact that we had gone and picked a player in a position that he doesn't normally play in because he's a quality player. Other countries do it and we don't. Deconstructed is a nice phrase, Andy. The kicks along the ground turned him constantly. And he would have and looked at times as if he was almost rushing to the line to make certain he was getting into a position to tackle. And England kicked more ball along the ground against Ireland, I'd say, than has been done for 5 or 6 years. And I think it caught us a little bit off. And that rustiness is, do you trust exactly where you are in your defensive position or your lineup? And I wonder, is he a bit bigger as well than he was when he played 15? But if he's considered one of the options, then he has to play more there. That's a guarantee. He has to. And for me, I don't know whether Will Addison sits as an option or Andrew Conway sits as an option, or even just to throw a little bit of fuel on the fire, whether Simon Zebo comes back into being an option or not. If Joe Schmidt thinks he is the fallback 15, now he also has Joey Carberry, by the way. And Joey Carberry has fit the bill at 15 whenever he's needed to, coming off the bench. And that's something else that we haven't fully discussed. But if he thinks that if there's going to be an injury and Rob Kearney's out and you need a 15 and you want it to be Robbie Henshaw, he's going to have to play a couple of times before we get to the World Cup.
Okay, we'll see what he does. And then finally, on what's going to happen in Rome, Keith, I saw Gordon Darcy kind of writing today and saying, you know, the basic tenet of the piece was, this isn't the worst game in Ireland for a way to actually remember to enjoy themselves playing rugby again, you know? Dry ball, nice stadium, agreeable opposition, and go out and throw it around a bit. What are you expecting on Sunday?
I still expect it to be fairly physical enough, because it tends to be. I was disappointed with Italy when they played against Wales. Wales, that was a game with a huge number of changes to the Welsh side. Italy had to go after it and had to be really disciplined, and they weren't. Mm-hmm. And that for me has kind of broken that possible resurgence for Italy. I mean, Ireland still need to be very disciplined. They still need to be very focused, and we can't take anything for granted. That one thing we know for certain. Mm-hmm. And if I think that we were mentally a little bit off against England, which I thought we were, and I thought it shook us, and I thought we were very nervous against Scotland. We still got the win. We didn't play as well as we would have liked to have. But now this is the next game. We have to do it. We have to try and see whether we are emboldened with our confidence that we can go out knowing we can win and then going and delivering it. That's what I would expect, and I hope that's what we see.
Okay, we'll move on. Our rugby coverage is brought to you by Vodafone, Team of Us, everyone in. Wales against England. Wales, Andy, have beaten England in 1949, 1959, 1969, 1979, 1989, 1999. 2009. Now, you don't need to be John Nash to figure out there is a pattern there.
Yes.
So I don't know if we need to be any more scientific than that in our analysis. It's 2019.
I think it's guaranteed.
QED.
Based on that, yeah.
Case over. England without Mako Vunipola, Mario Toje still absent, and Chris Ashton ruled out as well. They've had John Terry in speaking to them this week, actually, about leadership.
Oh, that was quite bizarre, yeah.
Yeah, Steve Borthwick said everybody was very engaged. It was a fantastic talk, so we'll see how that goes. I mean, they were obviously exceptional in Dublin, and then as bad as France were, there were still many brilliant aspects to their play in Twickenham as well. I'd say you enjoy the kicking game, do you? I'd say you're looking at Farrell and Daly and Slade and the variety in their kicking and their weight, these weighted little grubber kicks in behind.
I've loved it. I think
it helps when they've had Hooge and Robbie Henshaw both times.
Yes, yeah.
So Liam Williams is going to be a different prospect. That's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, they've had, I suppose, guys playing out of their typical position, so fair enough. But they've, I think they need to be applauded for, there's a lot of courage in playing a game that kicks the ball away in the opposition half in order to create pressure. It's a ballsy thing to do. Yeah. And I think it's really effective done well. And when it's done badly, you know, I've seen Finn Russell chipping balls away in opposite, and everyone just shakes their
terrible
head
and go,
what the hell is this guy thinking? So there's the key difference for me, the differentiating point with England's attacking game, is they're building the surrounding plays, the the plays beforehand. They're building it to set it up to kick.
Okay.
It's not an instinct. It's not an afterthought. I've nothing else on. I'm going to grubber it. They're
manipulating the defense.
They're manipulating the play whether it's through Eddie Jones and or Owen Farrell, and most likely both. There's a bit of puppets on a string going on, and it's really brilliant to watch executed well.
And are you seeing the kicks coming?
No.
Are you 2-3 phases ahead?
No.
Are you saying, oh, they're doing this?
I can see that they're setting up 2-3 options,
okay.
And the kick is one of them.
Okay.
And that's, again, is a brilliant tactic because it shows variation, yeah. And it puts hesitancy in opposition defence.
Do they have the most variation in their attack across the Six Nations?
Yeah, and more so than I've seen England in years.
Right.
And what it does is it causes hesitation in rush defences, which exactly is what Wales have.
Yeah.
And for that reason alone is the reason I think they're going to book the John Nash trend.
Well, it's unstoppable force. Johnny May, interestingly, who by the way has 12 tries in 12 tests at the moment,
yeah.
22 and 42 England games, he was talking about how the game is starting to suit him in a way. It ties in with the point you're making. He says, it's the way the game is at the moment. People want 14 men in the front line, aggressive defences, players getting off the line. Where does that leave the space? A lot of it's in behind.
Mm.
It suits me to sprint in behind. He says, maybe in 10 years' time, I'll go back to putting wings back, there'll be softer defences. There is a constant cyclical evolution. We're in this phase at the moment.
It's not even an evolution, it's just a cycle. It comes in and out of trend.
Yeah.
But when Gatland...
I said cyclical evolution, so I'm claiming...
Oh, okay, well, we're splitting hairs. But Gatland introduced the rush defence from 13 out. Suddenly your leader in defence, your leader of the line, was the guy 40 yards away from the breakdown.
Yeah.
That was never the case. So he brought that in early. That was a rugby league thing. He brought it into rugby union, and it caused havoc in attacking teams for years, until some genius somewhere went, well, why do we keep kind of running to the area where they're strongest? How do you stop a hard press in defence? You chip it in behind them, you grubber it in behind them, and it halts their speed. It takes the wind out of their sails, and it's a brilliant way to stop a rush defence, but it takes balls and courage to do it, because if it goes wrong, it looks awful, and you give away possession at a place where everyone expects you to be in command of your own game.
Yeah.
I really applaud them for doing it.
Keith, this is going to be a great game. I guess from an Irish perspective, we're hoping Wales win just to keep the thing reasonably alive with two rounds to go. How do you see it going?
Absolutely. I'm just going to touch on your point of it being cyclical. That rush defence we had on the Lions in 97, and it was a rugby league, and it was Welsh guys. Actually, and so things get forgotten an awful lot, you know, and they worked at a time and they worked for a reason, and the laws change every now and then. And once that happens, you kind of revert back to something that used to work in the past again. So I do think that the little chip along the ground is, I mean, it's unlocking everything at the moment because there's too many people in the defensive line. As a game down there, I think Wales are really high in confidence. I think some of that's proper confidence, and some of it is they had a cracking autumn beating Southern Hemisphere teams that they just never seemed to be able to ever beat, and they beat them, but they were beating teams, I feel, who were shattered and knackered. So I think some of the confidence doesn't, you know, because they are they 8 or 9 games or 11 games, are
11,
they now?
11, yeah,
11, yeah. 11 on the trot.
Yeah.
They're well able to play. They're well able to play badly. So great and all as they've beaten France over in France, they were abject for nearly 40 minutes of that game. And they're going to be under huge pressure. So it's going to be interesting to see how England are able to do that, what Gatland comes up with, what Wales come up with to counteract the fact that there are a huge number of options to play against them, and whether they're going to be able to meet the physical battle. I do think McGovern and Apola being out is an issue for England because he gives them subtlety and huge amount. I mean, for a big guy, I'm stunned by the Vunipolas. They're heavy guys. You know, they don't look the fittest guys in the world. Their work rate is extraordinary, both in terms of tackling and ball carrying and subtleties. So I think he's a loss, but I think having his brother on the field turns it over towards England. I think he just causes havoc, and I think Courtney Law's in instead of Itoje. is another man who just has havoc all over him.
Yeah. Okay. We're heading towards an English Grand Slam here, fellas. That's the uptake. So Scotland against France on Saturday. I mean, it's hard to know where to start. Guy Noves at the moment is suing the French Federation for unfair dismissal. He's looking for €3 million. He won 7 of 21. I see the French Federation, part of their case is that Noves had a brittle attitude towards the players and that there was a bad atmosphere in the French squad. Now, I would think Guy Noves is going to be able to point to the current situation and say, was it really that bad? Mm. So that's, you know, just part of the wide mess which is going on. 1999 is the last time the Scots won in Paris. They have no Finn Russell, they have no Stuart Hogg, and that is added to Hugh Jones, who's out for the tournament now, Barkley, Hamish Watson, WP Nell is still out, Ryan Wilson as well. So they have their fair share of injuries. And then as for France, Brunel has named his team 2 days early. Parra and Lopez gone. Brunel is saying it has nothing to do with the fact that they came out publicly and criticised management. So Dupont, who came on at Twickenham and generally considered to have done quite well, he comes in at 9. And then Intermac comes in at number 10, plays most of his rugby at 12 for Toulouse. Ouje is going from fullback to the wing. Thomas Ramos, also Toulouse, is going in at 15. And Fiku will start at 12. I mean, it is just insane stuff. If you take Intermac as an example of how a player is supposed to thrive, Andy, his first game of the Six Nations, 19 years of age, you know, I don't know how well or badly he does, but he's dropped for Twickenham. He comes on in Twickenham and there's footage of him saying, I don't know where I'm playing, to his fellow players. Mm. And there's arguments, like they're pointing there and he's like, I'm not sure, is it there? And then in his third game, he's played at number 10 and it's like, best of luck, kid. I mean, it is a blueprint in how not to allow players play their best stuff.
Yeah, kind of calamitous really to watch, but I immediately thought of Ireland getting a hiding down in Twickenham. I think it was 2001, and while it wasn't
2000,
yeah, okay. Woody, I think, remembers it very, yeah, very well.
Probably has a deeper memory.
But,
yeah,
but what happened was, now it's not quite comparable, but Stringer and O'Gara were drafted in to play against Scotland the following week, kind of for the first time.
Five players came in and made a debut. Yeah. But at least, look,
Shane Horgan came in.
Yeah, but that was a changing of the guard. This is like a constant issue.
But that was
issue.
A changing of the guard. Yeah, it is a constant. Like I said, it's not exactly comparable with France, but they need to back someone. And if they are going to pick a 20-year-old who, with great promise at 9, and Intermac has, you know, was a standout player at the World's Under 20s World Cup. Now, JJ Hanrahan, for example, won Player of the World Cup a few years ago for Ireland. It hasn't quite transferred for him yet, hopefully. But I think there's an element of pragmatism for once in that, and say it's wildly kind of left field as well at another time, but they've put in two guys. If they give them a chance...
Well, that's, I was just going to say, I would agree with you if they
give them a chance.
If you had any faith they would last more than two games.
Well, I have no faith that that's going to happen. But if they were to do it for the foreseeable future, build a team around a couple of kids who are very talented, but it's calamitous. You know, seeing a guy coming onto the field at that age who doesn't even know what position he's been sent on would really worry you about the levels of communication on the off the field.
Yeah. Not that it's overly worth analysing, Keith, but do you like the shape of this current back line?
I'm not sure whether I like it or not. I have all the same reservations. I think you need to protect the young guys that are coming in. He has the added benefit of having a father who knows what it is like to play at the highest level, and will tell him exactly how miserable it can be if you play badly at 19 years of age and don't play again for a while. It could be the best thing that ever happened to him, but it's you wouldn't trust it to be good. I thought Dupont played really, really well when he came on the other day. I think Entomac is a lovely footballer. I don't know whether he's a 10 or not. I don't know.
I think he has played 10 at underage, but with Toulouse, he's most certainly
a 12,
I think having a few more Toulouse players in it is good. They're not perfect, but they're playing the way the French teams that we all grew up watching and loved played. And there is a drive toward that being the case, apparently. But I can tell you that one thing that leads to a level of proper play is consistency of selection.
Yeah.
And we have had no consistency of selection in France for 10 or 15 years. So it's very hard to get bedded into the idea of what it is that is expected of you on an international field. It's very hard to understand how players react under white-hot pressure of international rugby. And it's one of the things that becomes very hard when you see some players not able to step up to the level. If things happen an awful lot quicker, you don't have the time to adjust, to get yourself in the perfect position. Nothing is perfect, and you have to react on the fly at a million miles an hour. And actually, some people are born to that, but a lot of people really, it might take 10 times. Now, 10 times before could have been 3 years. Now it's just over half a season. You know, 10 times to see what it is like to play at the high level, and you can get it. You don't get that if you play one position 1 week, another the next time, dropped for 6 weeks. You know, if you, there's nothing about consistency in that at all. I still find it almost hurtful because, you know, I've always said it, my favorite rugby player, and I wanted to be at 15 was Serge Blanco, because of growing up watching that joy and ability to run from everywhere or anywhere. Mm. You know, and we don't see a lot of that, or we see it mixed up with a load of rubbish.
Yeah. So what are we saying, as difficult it is as it is to predict how this particular French team will go? Are we saying Scotland minus Hogg and Russell will get their first win in Paris in 20 years?
No, I think they're missing too many key players, Scotland. I think a full-strength Scotland with confidence would be an entirely different prospect. Yeah. They were very underwhelming against Ireland also, and I know they're missing some key players, but their execution was quite poor. And that was a seminal game for this Scottish team. Say, have they arrived yet?
Yeah.
They haven't. And now they've got even more injuries to key players. But I still would be sweating quite heavily about playing the first game in the World Cup when everyone's fit again in Japan. I don't see them going to... I just don't see them winning in Paris. I think, unpredictable as the French are, this is one of their... Yeah. One of their great cliches.
There's nothing predictable about our conversation on them. No. Keith, are you going for France as well, despite everything?
I'm based on nothing. Really, the fact that they're playing at home, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I hope they have, like.
Based like on what side of the bed they get out of, it's actually probably gone to that.
But you almost don't want to say you want to see them play with discipline, because you want to see them play with abandon, is what you want, and for that to be brilliant and perfect. And the discipline being not giving away stupid penalties or having the fitness to last. But I'm not so certain that they have the fitness to last. So if they do play with abandon, I actually think that could put them under pressure in the second half. The things we're looking for may actually be their downfall as well. So it's kind of, I don't know if it's entertaining or not.
France win then.
I do think it is. I do think it is, because they're at home, and yeah, I think they're shocked, whether that's enough.
Okay, we'll see. Keith, thanks very much. Andy, thanks so much for coming to the studio.
Cheers, Joe.
We're done.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.